Hi, and welcome to the Imperial MBA Women podcast. Within business, we're often reminded about the importance of networking, and many of us would have attended a classic networking event, clutching business cards and a glass of wine, working the room. But how often are we aware of how impactful building relationships can be, and how can we focus on developing them authentically, especially in these times of COVID, when physically being able to network is out of bounds? In a corporate setting, we're often gifted with shared objectives, but we have all experienced pushbacks from colleagues, tricky relationships, and toxic team dynamics, alongside building friendships with teammates, allies that support your work, and colleagues who are just happy to help. But what happens when the success of your work, or working at all, comes from honing and leveraging your network of contacts? To highlight some of the most extreme strategic networking, I've drawn from the fast-paced, volatile, and exciting world of media, with guests Victoria Fritz, BBC presenter and journalist, and Kimberly Arms, freelance director and producer, to discuss the experiences of having to build and leverage their networks to meet their deadlines, no matter what. Thank you both for joining me today. Can you please give our listeners a short introduction to yourself? Victoria, starting with you.
Hi, Sam. Well, my job is actually very simple. It's effectively to listen well, to process a lot of data, to filter out the noise and really just reveal true patterns. So I must ask the right questions so that you, the listener, starts to learn something new, something you haven't heard of before. It's a little bit like being a sort of a human polygraph and an interrogator all at once. It means sometimes holding, of course, power to account, powerful people, powerful businesses. And sometimes it means lending my platform to someone else, sort of metaphorically holding their hand and letting their voice be heard. So it's really about judging the room.
Great. Thank you. And Kimberly?
Victoria, you knocked that out of the park. What an introduction. I'm terrified to go now. I'm not a presenter for a living. I'm a freelance producer and occasional director. I previously ran the video team at American Vogue in New York, and I was there for 2 years. And before that, I worked at the BBC. I launched video for Women's Hour and produced arts documentaries for BBC Arts.
So kicking off, let's be honest, building networks and relationships can be really scary, especially if you're doing it cold or straight off the bat. I'm pretty extroverted and I can still feel nervous approaching someone I might admire or who is significantly senior to me. What are your best anecdotes around taking the leap and it paying off? Kimberly, do you want to go first?
So I very boldly moved to New York about 3 years ago after my contract to the BBC ended. My parents are both American, so I have an American passport, and I've always been like, I'd like to work in New York. I knew no one, so hence the bold move. I blame the arrogance of youth. And 3 months in, I had completely depleted all of my savings, and I decided I had to go make rent by selling spiked lemonade on the beach. And so I borrowed a cooler off of someone who happened to be at a coffee shop with a producer who had just got an email from someone at American Vogue saying that their head of video had just left and they were looking for someone to do the job. And I was like, I could do the job. Tell them I am a shit hot producer. Took my cooler and bicycled the 2 hours to the beach with some vodka and some lemonade. And that evening, I got a message from the creative director saying that their CV had landed in their inbox. And did I want to come in for a meeting? So basically just, you have to tell everyone when you're looking for a job or you're a freelancer, just tell everyone what you can do and what you want to do. And it might land you with an interview with Anna Wintour.
That is amazing. I mean, what an experience. And did you meet Anna directly herself?
So I had the first meeting with the creative director, and then I had to send them a showreel, and then an email popped up saying from the office of Anna Wintour. And then that was 7 more interviews. And one of them was with her. I was so nervous, though. I immediately Googled, what do you wear for an interview with Anna Wintour? And helpfully, there was an incredible article by The Cut. And it was what 10 people wore to their interview and whether or not they got the job. The first one was I bought a whole new outfit from Barney's, cost £10,000, got the job. Second one was went to a thrift shop, did not get the job. I was like, oh, I managed to couple something together.
I guess it shows that by being super proactive and taking the guts to put yourself out there, we can benefit in ways rather than self-filtering and saying, oh no, I couldn't do that because I'm currently on my way to sell lemonade on the beach. But how about you, Victoria?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story about something with, I suppose, a happy ending, but it's mortifyingly embarrassing. One morning a few years back, my boss at the time, who was a pretty weird chap, if I'm honest, he sort of nonchalantly asked me whether I'd like to go pop into Downing Street with him to take tea with the Prime Minister. Apparently the PM wanted to plug Britain's industrial strategy or something. And it took me a moment to realise that my boss was actually being serious. So I agreed as casually as it's possible to do so when you're suddenly extended an impromptu invitation to, you know, effectively a private audience with a head of state. So off I toddled, completely daunted, totally unprepared, and really quite concerned about what my role was supposed to be. I mean, why on earth was I going to meet this guy? So we were ushered through all the rooms that you've seen in Love Actually with Hugh Grant dancing down the staircase, you know, that yellow staircase and things. And it is exactly like the film. And then we were sort of ushered through to this sort of inner sanctum. And there the Prime Minister was, and he sort of got up from this old-fashioned, kind of tassy paper-strewn desk. It was a bit more like a town hall than a sort of, you know, the Oval Office. And I sort of ushered over to this sort of threadbare sofa and sort of plonked my bottom down, thinking of all the far more worthier bottoms that had been on that sofa for the many sort of decades of prime ministers before me. And the tea comes in, and I'm sitting there thinking, I am 29 years old. What on earth am I doing having tea with the prime minister? And unfortunately, really, for me, the only conversation I actually had was the one that I had with myself, which was, you know, is it possible to eat shortbread biscuits without putting crumbs all down your front? You know, would it be impolite to circle back on these unsubstantiated claims he was making about Britain's industrial future? And, you know, a whole bunch of things. And who, if anyone, was expected to pour the milk? Because no one had poured the milk. And I'm sitting there looking at the milk thinking, well, I'll be damned if I'm doing it just because I'm the only woman in the room. And so no one poured the milk. And then eventually the PM poured the milk. And then he sort of asked me if I'd like milk. And I don't know why, but I just said no, which is not only weird, but not true. And he just sort of gave me the worst look. And I just didn't really speak to him at all. And I thought, I can't believe I've blown it. I've blown such a golden opportunity. I've sat there more worried about, you know, the biscuits and the milk than I was about anything else, and whether or not I'd be thrown into sort of professional Siberia by my boss by saying anything at all, by saying the wrong thing. And I was just completely paralyzed by procedure and some sort of notion of propriety. And I thought to myself, as I walked out completely ashamed of having wasted this opportunity, that I would never do so again. And I thought to myself, you know what, if you're in the room, you've got to be prepared to work the room. And it was then that I realized at 29, so I'd been working quite a while by that stage, that I would never do that again. And even if I'm socially awkward, and even if I find it difficult, you have to find ways to make connections and make it work for you.
What's interesting though, even though that doesn't have like the perfect outcome in that situation, it does really highlight how human we all are. So the PM, as much as yourself, like worrying about shortbread and who's going to pour the milk. And I think when it comes to networking, theoretically, authentic networks look at sort of building capacity for the future, just as well as just focusing on connections you need in the short term. Realistically, we need a combination of both. And that comes from obviously remembering that everyone is human and that there are always points of connection and similarities. It doesn't matter who you're speaking to. So when it comes to the short term, for both of you, and you might need to leverage a relationship quickly, how do you look to build trust? So it might be with other team members, it could be with someone that you're interviewing, Kimberly, it could be talent that you're working with for the first time, or clients. Victoria, go first. How do you sort of build trust in that short term?
So I think building trust is actually far easier than you might initially believe. I think, to your point, it's about authenticity. It's about listening, and it's engaging and just showing someone that you're interested, and that you're interested in them and interested in what they want to achieve. So, you know, on Zoom, for example, you could comment on what you can see behind them, you know, comment on their decor. In person, you're reading their body language. For me as a presenter, it's really important, if I can, to have chats in the green room with my guests beforehand, because some might be old hands, au fait with the whole procedure. Other people may have never done this before, and they're totally freaking out about being on national or international TV, about getting it wrong, about not being able to properly represent themselves or their business or their clients, and they feel that everything has sort of created this sort of huge sort of impetus into this particular moment where they're then sat terrified on the sofa with me. And I understand that. And so they, you know, what I do is I try and rehearse with them. I reassure, and I'm as relaxed as I can be, because people, they bounce off that. And so if you're reassuring and relaxed, they will also feel reassured and relaxed to some point. But it doesn't work all the time. So just for an example, you know, I was once, it was actually the hardest interview I've ever done, which was a gentleman who had been wrongly accused of murder and rape. I hadn't had time to meet him before. He was already predisposed to distrusting me. He felt that the BBC had not given him a fair hearing in a previous interview had done with someone else. It was a live interview. It was national television. He was incredibly emotional, and it was the most hair-raising interview of my life. And somehow I had to get him to trust me. And my heart was just beating out of my chest. I'm actually thinking about it now, just sort of thinking about the story. My heart is still racing now. He was accusatory. He was angry. I had a legal statement highlighted on my paper that I was holding just in case I get into hot water. And I just tried to zone everything out, and I tried to listen to him and to try and work out what he was trying to tell me, and to try and get through his bluster and anger to hear what he really wanted to say to me. And the interview was probably one of the best I've ever done. And it's one of the ones I'm most proud of, because it was so hard and because he was so inclined not to trust me. And by the end, it ran three times as long as it was supposed to. We had to chuck everything else out of the running order. It was really good. And I came off air, I burst into tears and I had to call my parents. But it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. But it was just about listening and engaging and realizing that the guy was only human.
No, absolutely. And I mean, Kimberly, you're on the other side of the camera and you're working with, you know, often very large teams. And you've already expressed that you always had that moment of trust with a connection, and they sent your CV through and you got given that opportunity. But you must have met lots of people, and the high turnover of work that you do, where you've had to sort of build relationships and trust. Do you have similar experiences to Victoria, or have you sort of done it slightly differently?
No one that was accused of rape. I normally work with models and celebrities, but in front of the camera, I completely agree that it's all about making people feel comfortable and feel the best that they can, because it's being on camera is incredibly scary, and you're there just to help them through that process. And the same with working with teams. I kind of feel as a producer that I'm a bit like a host at a dinner party where people don't know each other, and it's like your job to make sure that everyone feels really good so that they do the best that they can. So it's like communicating. And also, we're in an industry where we're really lucky that most people completely love what they do, and they have to, because sometimes it's not very well paid and it's incredibly long hours. But because of that, it means that there's already a sort of, it's a shared passion for something. So even if you've got nothing else in common, you're both in this industry together, and that's a place for building a relationship. But my tip, this is what I was going to say when I wrote down what I wanted to say to you, Sam, was basically when building and working as a freelancer, it really is all about doing like the best that you can in every single project. You're only as good as your last project. And then someone on that one can recommend you for something else. And then the next one, you have to be good and you have to be nice and you have to be hardworking, and people remember you and want to work with you again. And then that just slowly builds and builds.
No, that's a very good point, because there's a great quote that I'm not going to say absolutely perfectly, but people won't necessarily remember sort of what you said to them, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And I definitely think that there is a, you know, there's a real strength on, you know, being best self in, on every job that you do, because people remember that positivity and choose therefore to work with you again in the future. That is 100% very, very true. And when it comes to networks, though, in that kind of context, I'm a classic example of someone that in the past has proactively focused on developing career and professional networks. And it's really easy to take for granted our more personal networks and overlook how we can leverage them sometimes. What networks have you invested in or developed, and what benefits have you seen come from that? Kimberly, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I really feel like I used my friends a lot. I once hired a friend for a project and she could not believe what I was like at work. She was like, "You are exactly the same at work as you are anywhere else." But I'm very lucky. I've grown up in London, and apart from that brief stint in New York for a couple of years, like I have met so many people. My partner always takes the mickey out of me because he's like, everyone that I meet, I call a friend very quickly. Like I could have met them for 5 minutes and then I was like, my friend from the other day. And because of that, I've just built a ginormous network of people, so that in any sort of field, I feel like I could text someone and ask them a question, or they'll know someone and pass it along. So yeah, I feel incredibly lucky that I have been able to build up this huge network. And not everyone, like I'm very aware that in our industry, not everyone has that opportunity. My parents saved all their money and put it into putting me and my brother to these day schools in London, that I met all these people, that I can leverage those relationships. Our industry is very correctly criticized for being hard to crack into, and it's very white and it's very middle class. And I haven't really been a part of or seen many schemes that have been able to fix this. I am involved in something called Outrunners, which is this amazing charity run by a guy called Tyler, who combines doing a running club for people in Hackney with outreach for kids in Hackney who want to learn more about careers and career development. And I think it's a really great project, and I would love to see more things like that popping up that actually helps find kids and connect them with people in the industry that can help, because people in this industry are looking for like people of diverse backgrounds with amazing ideas and amazing talent, but there just seems to be this like connective tissue that isn't properly in place yet. People hire who they know and who they like, and so often that is just like people like them. I think everyone's goal for 2021 and beyond should be to take a couple more chances on people this year.
No, I agree. And it's so easily done when you're busy and you want to recruit people fast, and you're looking, and there's someone that looks like you, talks like you, and thinks like you that you can slot in. But unfortunately, that means that we tend to go on the side of bias, and we're not necessarily opening up opportunities to diversity in the way that, if we've got a little bit more time on our hands, which I don't know about you, but I don't commute for 2 hours a day anymore, I don't really have the excuses. So there's definitely lots of opportunities to build that, I think, moving forward, and no more excuses. Victoria, how about you? How have you sort of built your networks outside of a professional environment?
Well, it's just a slightly tricky one because I'm also a mum to two children. I have dogs, chickens, all sorts of other things. So, you know, I don't have a huge amount of additional time beyond work. But one thing I do care about and have done since I was tiny is sort of nature, landscape and gardening. And I created this sort of a bit of a side hustle called The Social Gardener. And the idea really was to be sort of instrumental in creating a social network of gardeners for gardeners, so that we could all learn from each other, to welcome new people, to inspire. And it could be global. Anyone can follow, anyone can join and learn and comment. And it's a sort of a place really for people to meet and connect. And so it's really sort of forming this network of effectively, in some ways, freelancers are people at home doing their own thing, trying to maybe build their own business, or maybe it's just something that they enjoy in their free time. And so this is something that I really love doing. I spend quite a lot of time doing it whenever I can, and I make videos and I share content and I reply to lots of stories, and I form some really great virtual friendships, which is feels like a very sort of new age thing to say, but there are people who I know and regularly talk to, you know, sometimes in some instances daily, that I have never met, and I value their expertise and their experience and their support as well, because we also share our ups and downs and our failures. And you know, this last year with COVID, lots of people have turned to nature and turned to outdoors and turned to growing and nurturing things as a way to console themselves or find some form of security. So it's been a really interesting and uplifting year from that perspective, to have this network that I've been able to give other people, but also has supported me through, you know, quite a tough period of time for me and for everyone else.
And actually, it's interesting what you say about the support element of networks, because I don't know about you, but initially when I started thinking about this topic, and then my first step was to review my own. So I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, and it can be quite self-promoting, but actually any relationship and a network is a two-way thing, and you need to focus as much on the support that you can give others and that you then rely on when you're building out, reaching out, or trying something different, which takes us on to our final question, which is that many of our listeners will consider going freelance or becoming consultants within their career. Whether it's searching for the next story or building a client base as a freelancer, what skills do you rely on, and what actions would you recommend others to focus on when considering that path? Victoria, do you want to go first?
Sure. So in terms of freelancers and freelancing, I think, you know, it's such a huge and valuable part of the sort of economic ecosystem. I mean, people have got these extraordinary specialisms, and they can turn their hand to all sorts of different situations, and they're invaluable. They might be more readily available. They tend to have lower overhead. So it's really important, if you're not a freelancer yourself, to have a good network of them and be plugged into a good network of freelancers. And equally, as you say, it's hugely important, I think, that it is a two-way street. So promote people as widely as you can, because 20 minutes spent name-checking people on social media, writing quick reviews, sending someone sort of quite formal feedback so that they can use that in their own marketing material perhaps, or their next pitch to their next client. It's all part of a social contract that you have with other people, with people within your network, and it does benefit you both. It might generate more income for them, but then they will probably work harder to try to shift their schedules around to be able to help you out later on down the line. So, you know, it is really important. It doesn't matter who you are talking to, whether it's a plumber, a postman, a web developer, a social media guru, a drone operator. There is value to be had in taking all of these wonderful people seriously with all the things that they do, because you never know when you might be able to help them or they might be able to help you. And, you know, it's about fostering those relationships and making sure that when they think about you, or when you pop up in their head and or pop up in conversation, they remember how it is that you made them feel. And so it's about making sure that your interactions with people leave them feeling good and feeling positive. And that's something that you can do all the time. And, you know, if you get into the habit of doing that, it doesn't matter who you're talking to, whether you're going off to speak to school children to try to get them to understand fact from fiction, you know, be able to sniff out fake news, you know, schemes like that, or whether or not you are going to deliver a pitch to a CEO. If you realize that everyone you talk to, you're capable of making them feel valued and making them feel heard and understanding their needs, you go a long way to having them on side before you've ever really done anything to further your own agenda. So I think that's a basic human skill that we can often take for granted. And, you know, it's important to remember that all the conversations and interactions that you have are just with people. And they're people with often quite similar problems and experiences to your own. It's easy to get caught up in the differences of rank or stature or country or language, but actually people often have very similar concerns about imposter syndrome, about finances, about things that we all have worried about at some point in time. So you just have to find the commonalities and promote.
No, I definitely agree. And I mean, Kimberly, you have got my favorite story, I think, of making a connection work for you. I'm going to look at Lemonade never in the same way again. But do you have any final comments just to finish us off around what skills people can take moving forward?
Yeah, I think to be a freelancer, it does really take a certain type of disposition. I'm not entirely sure I have that type of disposition. I think I'm a bit more of a company gal, but you have to be very resilient because it's similar to an actor going to loads of castings. Like, people are not going to hire you for a project lots and lots of times, and you can't take that personally, even though sometimes it does feel personal. And you have to be a real self-starter. So every day you're making your own work. You're not going to work. You have to make your work. And that's tough. And like me and Victoria were saying about being your best self in every opportunity, that can be completely exhausting. So you also have to be kind to yourself. And that's something I'm trying to teach myself now. And when you're so connected to the work that you do because you're so passionate and you love it, it can become your whole life. And my biggest learning, as we say in America, recently has been that it shouldn't be, that there are all these other amazing things about life that you can switch off that part of your brain and do, like cooking or being with a loved one or going for a walk. And all of that is really exciting, and it gives you a valuable opportunity just to like switch off.
No, and I mean, very timely words for the unique existence we're all living at the moment, because now we're working at the office, as we like to say, and people are working from the same table they ate their Christmas dinner off. It's really important, I think, moving forward to remember to take that time out, and it will also make you a better version of yourself to take forward. Right, on that note, I'd like to thank you both so much for taking part. It's been brilliant to have you on.
We hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. Please follow or subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast across Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And we'll be back with the next episode in 2 weeks' time. If you'd like to find out more or join the Imperial MBA Women's Network, connect with us on LinkedIn or Instagram. See you next time.